From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In the history of medicine, the practice of psychosurgery, also known as psychiatric neurosurgery or lobotomy, was controversial in its origins and continues to be the subject of medical, social, and scientific debate. Psychosurgery developed in the 1920s and 30s as a biological intervention used as treatment for mental disorders. The practice came to the United States under the aegis of two American medical scientists, Walter Freeman and John Fulton. What are some of the factors that led to the rapid adoption and practice of psychosurgery, which reached a peak of about 50,000 operations in the 1950s? What are some of the bioethical issues surrounding psychosurgery today? Those are among the questions posed in a forthcoming history of psychosurgery by one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Elliot Valenstein is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. He's the author of two books about psychosurgery, as well as a report on neurosurgery for the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research. Here is Elliot Valenstein.
From the very beginning, it was quite controversial. There were many people that thought these operations were mutilating the brain, that they were had a very poor scientific basis. The main problem was, and the reason why there was such a ready group to seriously consider these operations, even though the science was really very poor, was that there were so many people in hospitals receiving no help at all.
People with emotional problems.
People with serious emotional problems. Uh-huh. Many of them were psychotic individuals. Many of them had psychological states of such extreme emotional tension that they couldn't function at all.
Who are the candidates for this operation?
Well, they were people whose lives were so disrupted by mental anguish that they couldn't function. They were either initially in state hospitals, or they were people who had somehow been managing at home but could no longer function in a normal way and were seeking help and couldn't find any. Originally, my interest was that of a laboratory scientist, because I do study the brain and I do study its role in regulating behavior. Mostly, I work in a laboratory with animals using experimental procedures. But I did become involved in this issue in a clinical sense, that is, with humans as patients, because the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects turned to me and asked me to do a survey around the world of the amount of these brain operations, the amount of psychosurgery that was being performed, and who were the people that it was being performed on, and what in general was the outcome. And as a result of that, I became interested in not only the clinical side, in addition to my original scientific interest, but I also became interested in some of the historical issues. How come this operation was so readily accepted and spread so widely when it was such a crude operation with such poor scientific foundation?
Well, let's pause on that for a moment. Why did it become accepted? Was it a sort of last-ditch kind of thing, that we've got to do something to help people who are severely emotionally distressed?
That was a good part of it, Wayne. You have to remember that when these operations were first introduced in 1935, 1936. The first publication was in 1936. I'm excluding some earlier historical antecedents, but it first seriously was proposed and adopted by a number of people around the world following a publication by a Portuguese neurologist.
Did it start in Portugal?
Yes, it actually started in Portugal. A man named Igas Moniz, a very fascinating man who had a very eminent career as a diplomat, as an ambassador, as a foreign minister of Portugal, a man of a very distinguished family, who probably hoped to make a success out of his political career. And when things in Portugal didn't turn out the way he had anticipated them, he seriously began to look back at medicine. He, of course, he had had a medical degree, uh-huh. and began to do work in medicine. But at that time, there was very little treatment available, almost no treatment available.
What kind of treatment was available? Was it drugs?
Of course, there were some drugs around, but none of the drugs that we currently think of as having some value for psychotic individuals.
So what are we talking about?
We're talking about bedlams, snake pit environments.
Oh boy.
These are periods when Deutsch and a number of other people began to write about the horrible conditions in the huge asylums around the United States.
Deutsch being
Albert Deutsch, who wrote Shame of the States and a number of other books about mm-hmm. describing the mental the asylums, really, yeah. as they were called at that time. But the only drugs that were available were opiates, which were used occasionally to sedate people, bromides, sedatives, but no specific drugs like the kinds of drugs that we think now act rather specifically on mm-hmm. as antidepressants or anti-schizophrenic drugs. Chlorpromazine, the first of those more specific drugs, was not introduced until 1953. So it's all prior to that period.
Elliot, let's talk about, I guess, what you might characterize as the popular notions, the popular conceptions of psychosurgery. And I think of movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Snake Pit. How much of a connection is there between these kind of popular notions, the word lobotomy, for instance, you remember Tennessee Williams suddenly last summer, and what really goes on in psychosurgery?
Well, the original operations were nothing short of mutilation. Mm-hmm. They are almost too violent and too bloody to describe for most audiences. They involve drilling holes in the skull mm. and putting knives relatively blindly into the brain and rotating them in such a way to cut the fibers that were, in a sense, isolating a good part of the prefrontal lobes, that is, the part of the brain that's just behind your forehead.
Elliot, let me ask you to pause on that. How did the doctors figure out that these violent emotions originated in the frontal part of the brain? I mean, how you know a good bit about the geography of the brain. Tell me about that.
Well, the origin of that is sort of interesting, and it had been around for 40 or 50 years that the prefrontal area, that is the most forward part of the brain, probably played an important role in what used to be called higher mental functions, intellectual life, associations. By that time, by even the turn of the century, 1900, good parts of the cerebral cortex, the top layer of the brain, the function of it had been identified. They knew which areas were sensory areas, that is, which received information from our eyes and from our ears, which controlled movements of the body. But there were other areas that didn't seem to have any function, and it was assumed that those areas played some kind of integrating role.
So
probably where thinking went on.
Yeah, and they experimented, is that it?
Doctors? They were animal experiments on various kinds of animals, including primates, including monkeys. And the general conclusion was, even though it was hard to describe, that in some way animals were deprived of this part of the brain, were unable to integrate material as well. They mm-hmm. could function fairly well on a simple biological level, but when it came to various kinds of problem solving, there seemed to be difficulties.
Well, now, let me ask you to consider this one. I suppose it'll sound terribly naive to you. Is emotion physical? I mean, are you psychosurgeons, and you as a historian of psychosurgery, are you saying that the tissue itself is the source of the emotion, that you are the emotional distress that you're trying to eliminate?
Well, of course, that's a very difficult question, Wayne, because you're really asking me about the mind-body problem or the mind-brain problem, one that no one, to my knowledge, has really satisfactorily solved. But I think in practical terms, I think there is a reasonable amount of evidence that there are certain parts of the brain that control those responses of the body that normally are very active during emotional states. That is, there are some parts of the brain that control sweating, pupillary dilation, heart rate, all of the things that become very active when we get very emotional. Mm-hmm. And there was reason to believe that they may also, these areas of the brain may also play a role in the psychological concomitants of these physiological representations of emotion, because animals that had these regions destroyed looked a little bit more placid, less mm-hmm. impulsive, less emotional.
Yeah.
It's always hard to make generalizations from animals. It's much easier working with humans when you can talk to them and draw some conclusions.
Elliot, let me ask you this. Does psychosurgery involve fixing the emotions or eliminating the emotions? Or is there a sort of middle ground there in the sense that what you're after is truly therapeutic?
Well, what the people were after initially was to reduce some emotions. These mm-hmm. candidates, although when lobotomies became most popular, they began to be applied quite widely. But the core of the patient population were those with exaggerated emotional states. Their fears, anxieties were so great that they were with them all the time and prevented them from living normally. They were obsessed with ideas so that they couldn't pay attention to other things. They became fixated on the fact that the whole world was dirty and polluted, and they couldn't touch anybody or go outside of their apartment or house, making life completely impossible. So for these people, those who were in favor of these operations felt that some reduction of emotional response, even though after the operation these people might say, yes, I still think the world is dirty, but in everyday life they could now go out and function somewhat and forget about their fears and concerns. So it was a reduction of emotion.
Elliot Valenstein, you're writing a history of psychosurgery. Tell me, in both, I suppose, historical as well as contemporary terms, what are some of the ethical questions that surround the practice of psychosurgery? What kind of dialogue exists? What kinds of questions do the doctors ask themselves, and how do they talk to their patients?
Well, there are many questions that come up, and most of the questions, interestingly enough, are not unique to psychosurgery, but they deal with all kinds of innovative interventions in the field of mental health. For any kind of physical intervention, you want the compliance and agreement from the patient. And when you're dealing with someone who is mentally disturbed, there's always the question of how do you get the consent? Yeah. How do you get an informed consent from
right.
someone who is not quite stable?
Sticky issue.
Mentally.
Huh?
And that's a sticky issue, of course. The issue that is that comes up with psychosurgery, which is also not unique, is the fact that the region of the brain that is being destroyed is not a region that anyone can demonstrate is diseased in any way.
Uh-huh.
It's healthy tissue. And the brain does not regenerate like some other organs in the body will when they're destroyed. If a part of the liver is destroyed, that will regenerate in time. But that's not true of the brain. Once the brain is destroyed, those cells are permanently lost. So an issue that comes up is what right is there to destroy a part of the brain which represents the organ that enables man to fulfill his most human aspirations.
How do they answer that in terms of the quality of one's life, in terms not so much of the operation itself as what it's going to lead to?
Essentially that. It's a very economic type of answer. It's risks.
You mean
losses versus gains.
Sustaining the patient.
For people who will find these operations acceptable, they will say, well, if a person's emotional experiences after this are a little bit less rich, that loss is worth is acceptable if it makes it possible for this person to live a more normal life.
Mm-hmm. Are these people, to use a harsh word, vegetables? I mean, what are the effects of psychosurgery? Do they vary in any appreciable sense?
Oh, they certainly do vary, and that is part of the complexity of the issue. There's no doubt where these operations were done excessively, where things went wrong. There were people who were reduced to pretty much a vegetable or zombie status. But there are many examples that were in the literature and well documented of people with advanced education who went back to work at in professional positions, positions of considerable responsibility after the operation.
So that's reassuring to hear. It doesn't always lead to the direst of consequences.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think that it's a mistake to, even those people who oppose the operation, I think it's a mistake for them to criticize the operation on the grounds that everyone becomes reduced to a zombie.
Yeah.
Because anyone who is familiar with these procedures know that that's not true, and their whole argument loses credibility.
How has the practice evolved? How does it go on today, for instance, by contrast with these early, apparently very crude sorts of psychosurgery?
Well, over the years, the operation became more and more refined. Initially, large areas of the brain were destroyed. And if the first operation on a patient did not seem to produce sufficient effects, a second operation destroying even more areas of the brain were done, involving greater risk and the greater possibility of producing what we called before in our conversation a zombie or a vegetable. But as experience was gained, and of course there were many patients who paid the price for this experience, it became clear, or it seemed to become clear, that only certain parts of the brain provided the beneficial effects when destroyed and reduced these exaggerated emotional states, and that a lot of the other destruction were destroying some of the intellectual capacities of people. So the operation became more and more targeted to specific areas, whereas initially it was a very massive kind of operation.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about psychosurgery, which is the practice of biological intervention for the treatment of mental disorders. My guest is Elliot Valenstein, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. Professor Valenstein recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming history of psychosurgery. Elliot Valenstein is the author of books and articles about the scientific, legal, and ethical aspects of brain operations on psychiatric patients. Is it a widespread practice? Is psychosurgery a widespread practice today?
No, not at all. Certainly when compared to the peak period, which really was between 1948 and 1952. That's an interesting period because the procedure, although it was tried in a number of places very, very rapidly, World War II broke out. And of course, everyone's attention was devoted to that, and a lot of medical people were drawn up into the army for military service. But after the war, there still was nothing around to help these patients. People began to pay attention to the terrible conditions in the state hospitals. There were all these physicians, surgeons, psychiatrists that were returning from the army, and they turned to this operation. And within 4 or 5 years, the numbers of operations increased each year geometrically above the preceding year, until it got up in the United States to a rate of about 5,000 operations a year.
Now, it's not that high now.
No, it's nothing like that now. And the largest reason for its decline, besides the fact that more and more people became aware of these side effects that we were talking about that sometimes could be produced, was that an alternative became available.
And what was that?
The alternative was the psychotropic drugs, that is the chlorpromazines and the reserpin first, and then the whole list of other drugs that offered an alternative, particularly for the patients in the state hospitals, where their numbers were increasing. There was a time when anyone committed to a state hospital was thought to have a good chance of spending their life in that hospital. They were not being discharged in great numbers. They were staying there. So people were very receptive to any hope that might be extended.
Elliot Valenstein, we're talking about psychosurgery. We're talking about your history of psychosurgery. Generally, when people talk about medicine, they talk about the future, medicine as a frontier. Why do you think it's important that you write a history of psychosurgery? And consider also this question: who are your audiences? Who are you writing to? What kind of an effect upon these audiences would you like this history of psychosurgery to have?
Well, the way I am writing this book, Wayne, is I'm putting it in the context of a number of other kinds of physical interventions into the body that were done at the same period of time, and were really based on very poor scientific foundation. You know, at one time in the 20s, there was a theory that was discussed quite a bit in the psychiatric circles that mental disorders came from focal infections that were producing toxins that were spreading to the brain.
From what kind of an infection?
Focal.
Focal, not vocal.
No, not vocal, but focal. Okay. Somewhere in the body, there was an infection. And the most obvious place to begin with was the teeth. And in the state hospital in Trenton, New Jersey, there was a man named Henry Cotton who saw to it that most teeth were extracted from the patients in the hospital.
Well, just parenthetically, didn't Dr. Freud have a colleague who concentrated on the nose?
Yes, Fleece was kind of preoccupied with the nose. Yeah. But it's interesting that this this focal infection theory was propounded by a man who also had quite good credentials. He had studied with Adolf Meyer, one of the leading figures in American psychiatry, and he not only removed many teeth of people, but tonsils, other organs. He did very serious operations. He actually operated on the colon, the large intestines, thinking that they were the source of infection.
All right, now let me stop you, Elliot. You're sort of smiling as you're telling me about this. I take it that today's medical practitioners and you as a medical historian in this instance, we're talking about psychosurgery, you're looking back on this and saying, wow, how could we have bought all of that? Do I have that right?
Well, not quite, because I can understand how we could have bought it. It's not an unreasonable theory.
Uh-huh. I mean, as you're looking for physical origins.
I think looking for physical origins, and there's nothing wrong with looking for physical origins, although by no means should one assume that that all mental disorders are physical in origin. But that was one of the issues that still exists today. You know, the biological psychiatrists today and the functional psychiatrists, and that was the way they were characterized back in the period that I'm talking about, still have very strong disagreements about the value of psychotherapy versus the value of biological interventions. Mm-hmm. The ones we think of now are more biochemical right now, because that seems to be the hot subject, biochemical cures. But it's basically the same argument about biological or organic explanations versus psychological ones. I don't think that the science is much more sophisticated than it was initially. It is somewhat. We do, of course, know a lot more about the brain than we did at that time.
When you say the science is not, you mean in the sense that what it calls for is the destruction of tissue?
Yes, it still calls for the destruction of the tissue, but the techniques are much more sophisticated. Uh-huh. The techniques now are of such a nature that the procedure is relatively safe. It's probably as safe as an appendectomy.
Is it painless?
Yes, it is painless. It's a surprise to many people who don't know too much about the brain that the brain can be touched and poked without people feeling it. So that the organ, the paradox is that the organ that is the instrument by which we sense the world and have all these rich emotional experiences
cannot itself,
when it's physically touched, doesn't really respond and evoke very much in the way of emotions. And a lot of surgery, quite aside from psychosurgery, on the brain is done with awake patients because it is helpful for the surgeon to localize where they are in the brain by getting the patient to respond or not be able to respond when certain parts of the area are stimulated electrically.
Is it possible, Elliot, to generalize about the kind of lives, in terms of quality of life, that a patient who has experienced psychosurgery lives? Do these patients live in mental institutions? Do they live at home? Has that improved in any sense?
Yes, I think so, because these very drastic adverse effects of these operations that used to happen, where people were reduced to vegetables and zombie states, or at least some of them were, seldom happens anymore, because the operation is done with a relatively safe procedure. It's targeted more specifically at a particular area of the brain. The destruction is much more limited, and that. While there may be some people who are not helped by the operation, they are not obviously damaged in any way. And the people who receive these operations are not the people who are most seriously disturbed mentally in terms of thought disorders. They aren't the deteriorated schizophrenics that are not making any sense. These are people who are making sense, but they come to you with some irrational fear that they cannot control, that no psychiatrist has been able to help them with, that no drugs seem to be able to alleviate.
Elliot Valenstein, let's conclude. Tell me, what would you have a general audience know about psychosurgery? What are the important things? Do you have a kind of an argument here or a thesis that you are bringing to your history of psychosurgery?
Well, I think one of the main theses has to do with the conditions that facilitate the uncritical acceptance of new procedures, the ill-placed enthusiasm that makes a procedure be so widely accepted when it has very poor foundation, used very extensively, and suddenly, or not so suddenly, after 4 or 5 years or 6 or 7 years, realize that we've been oversold on this procedure, that it has some side effects that were never looked at more closely.
So the fact that you're writing a history of psychosurgery doesn't necessarily mean that you endorse it in all instances.
Oh, by no means do I endorse it in all instances, and sometimes that's an embarrassment. People think that I, because my name occasionally will come up in the newspapers because I did a survey for the government, they think that I am doing these operations, and I will get calls reflecting people's opinions about these operations.
Right.
No, I'm writing a history just as someone who might be writing a history of some atrocity or some other event in history is certainly not endorsing it, but I'm describing it because I think it is a story which has its counterparts today, although they'll take different forms, and we can learn much from it.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about psychosurgery. My guest was Elliot Valenstein, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and the author of a forthcoming history of psychosurgery. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Martin Mizell of Columbia University will discuss his research project at the center entitled The Imagination of Chaos in Western Literature and Thought. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about the history of psychosurgery. Psychosurgery, also known as psychiatric neurosurgery or lobotomy, originated amidst controversy in the 1920s and continues to be the subject of medical, social, and scientific debate. What are some of the factors that led to the adoption of psychosurgery? What are some of the ethical issues surrounding its practice today? Listen for some answers from Elliot Valenstein, one scholar at the National Humanities Center, the author of a forthcoming history of psychosurgery. Medical History and Psychosurgery, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.